Since the show began almost 2 years ago, a change of tune has highlighted some of the best up-and-coming artists out of these West Virginia hills, with podcasty chats ranging from Tyler Childers to Ona, Bud Carroll to Coyotes and Boxes, and beyond. But those interviews have been a bit infrequent. And since West Virginia Day was this month, and with a change of tune's second birthday just around the corner, we thought we'd do something special. 30 days, 30 brand new West Virginia music interviews that range from Morgantown alt rockers and Parkersburg senior songwriters to West Virginia music venues and regional artist management and beyond, all of which contribute to the state's wild and wonderful music scene. And for our final West Virginia music chat, we are talking with Kanawha by way of Logan County multi-instrumentalist Jeff Ellis. After playing in a number of local bands over the years, including Harvest and Guinness Clark's Wine, and releasing more than a few solo records himself, Jeff is ready to show the world his new band and his new sound, but not before giving us an idea of the number of West Virginia music people who have helped him along the way. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. Do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do in West Virginia?
Okay.
That's a big question.
This will be 30 minutes of your interview. Well, my name is Jeff Ellis. I currently live in South Charleston, West Virginia. I work as a police officer for the South Charleston Police Department, and I'm a sergeant first class in the Army Reserves, 18 years in now, and I'm also a singer-songwriter, aspiring musician.
So you don't go by the title of like the singing cop, right?
No.
That's not like a nickname people give you.
I usually try to keep each of those things, you know, separate and unique, but it eventually spills over. But yeah.
What did you want to become first? Did you want to become a musician first? Did you want to become a cop first? Or, and it's okay if I say cop, is that
yeah,
right?
That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not easily offended.
Okay.
the musician was always, I mean, I've always wanted to be a musician since I was probably 11, 12 years old. Like I've played music, I've written songs, and I've always strived to, you know, to get better. And ultimately I would love to do that for a living and make enough money to support a family on that. But I'm sure like probably Todd and Ian said in earlier interviews, if music is the only thing you're doing, you're going to have a hard life. And
you're not going to have a good time.
Exactly.
Well, you will have a good time, but it's just going to be
you'll
a
have
very
a good time.
Stressful
it
time.
May be short-lived and very stressful. But, you know, there were other things I wanted in my life. So, you know, I wanted to have a family and kids and everything. And I made a decision early on that at 17, as a matter of fact, that I was going to have, I don't want to call it a fallback plan because it's really not a fallback plan. It's more like a dual career, I guess. It's actually the only reason I joined the Army Reserves instead of active duty is because I was like, well, in the Reserves, you know, I can do my 1 week in a month, go do some active duty time, make enough money to where I can still play music and work a part-time job. And that worked out for a while. And, you know, time just kind of went by. And 18 years later, here I am.
Has it really worked well, though? I mean, I know recently, like last year or two, I've interacted with you. And I've, you know, like I for West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I've done these kind of, they're called Why Listen events, where we premiere new music. We actually premiered your a demo from your upcoming record.
That's right.
At one of them, at the Charleston Why Listen event at Black Sheep Burrito and Brews. And you were so excited for it, and then you weren't able to make it for your own music debut premiere because of having to be away.
In that regard, it hasn't worked well.
Yeah.
So I will say there are definitely sacrifices, but I mean, financially speaking and able to travel, it has worked well. Like I've got to spend a year in Austin, Texas. I've got to spend a year in Fayetteville, North Carolina. You know, I've spent too many years in Iraq and Kuwait and places like that. But you know, each time I go do this, I'm able to save up a fairly good amount of money. So when I come back, all the songs that I've written during that time period, I'm able to go into a studio. I can fund it myself. I can hire and pay the musicians a little bit. And it also kind of gives me a chance to go play in those areas that I normally wouldn't get to. So in that regard, it's worked well, but there have been a lot of sacrifices. Like in 2002, for example, I had a chance to go out and do a demo with Rain from Our Lady Peace. And I was stationed at Fort Bragg at the time, and I'd met him in Columbus, Ohio, and slipped him a demo like a couple weeks before. And just like the stars aligned, the dude calls me. He was super cool. I went and met him in Pittsburgh, you know, sat on the tour bus, was backstage hanging out, and he was supportive of the songwriting and whatnot. And then he shoots me an email and is like, hey, you want to come out to California for a weekend and record a demo? So I go to my command at Fort Bragg and They're like, Our Lady who? No, we're not going to give you a 4-day pass to go out and make a demo with a rock star. And that sucked real bad.
Do you think they would have been fine with it if it had been someone that they knew? Like
Hank Williams Jr.? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Or like Bob Dylan or Petty?
I would hope so. But I mean, I guess that's probably my biggest beef with the military. And it's ultimately, I did an active duty stint in 2003 to 2007 to where I was like, you know, I'll make this my career. And it only took, you know, 2003 to 2007 to where I was like, nope. But my beef with that was they just have so much control over your life. And on active duty, it was almost impossible to have a dual career because I would book these shows. And then at the last minute, the Army would say, you can't go do that.
Yeah.
Which, you know, on the reserve side, they have control, but it's a limited amount of control, you know, especially after 18 years. It's not like, you know, if I miss a drill, I'm not going to get put out.
Yeah. So it sounds like, though, you are getting enough material being on the road, traveling around, meeting new people to make the music. What are you inspired by whenever you're away from home?
You know, that's a good question. And I kind of think that's why I write so much is because of, like, I've always fed off life experiences. So, I mean, the more I do outside of music, the more I have to write about. I kind of wonder if music is all I did, what I would write about. You know what I mean? If that makes sense.
Yeah. Because you'd have the same pool to work from instead of you working in different areas and seeing different things.
Exactly. And I think, you know, looking back over the material that I've recorded, some of my favorite and probably better songs have stemmed from, you know, time working as a police officer and some of the characters I've encountered there, you know, time spent away from my family with the military, because that brings on all kinds of feels, you know, being away from home.
Yeah.
And I think for the material anyways, that's worked out pretty well. It's just like I said, the sacrifices of what I can and can't do as a musician. You know, I'm obviously not able to go play as many shows as I'd like to do, or, you know, to go do a tour across the United States and back. But to be able to do 4 or 5 nights, or to go out, especially with the police department I work on now, we get a 7-day break every month. So I can plan little, you know, 4 or 5 day jaunts and come back and just go right back to work.
Where have you played around West Virginia?
Oh, man. Obviously, I lived in Huntington for 10 years, so I played there a lot. Actually, we had me and my piano player, Phil James, had a residency at the V Club every Thursday for 2 years. And that's how I met a lot of the musicians in the area.
Like
and,
Bud Carroll, I assume.
Well, I knew Bud maybe a year or two before we started doing that. But that's probably about the time we started getting close.
Okay.
I've got a good Bud story I'll tell you in a bit.
I can't wait.
But, you know, we did Huntington and Charleston a lot. Around, I guess, 2006, 2007, we started getting up and doing Shepherdstown, Beckley. Adam Harris actually booked a tour for us in 2010 and another one in 2011 to where we went up and played like the Purple Fiddle. There was a place, I think it was in Elkins, called Jabberwock or something like that. We played there.
Sounds like a cool place.
It was not that cool of a place.
Okay.
The Purple Fiddle was awesome, and maybe it was because we came from the Purple Fiddle and then went to the Jabberwock, but you know, the Purple Fiddle, we were kind of like, everybody was there for us. The Jabberwock, it was like we were the Wallflowers, and it was kind of not our scene.
Yeah.
But I guess Southern West Virginia, too. We started out, when I first started playing in a band, my first band was Harvest. It was like a high school rock band, and we played Man, Logan, you know, a lot of the places down in Southern West Virginia.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, I don't know if Tim talked about it, but Logan Man area had a pretty decent music scene 20 years ago. Chris Ojeda from Byzantine started there. You know, Daniel Johnson, Tim, myself, and a whole bunch of other people that are still active all came from that Logan area. And there was this little place called The Liberty, which was like the back of a pawn shop, but it had a huge, like, music hall-sized spot in the back. And a bunch of teenage kids and maybe some college students just put together this little weekend thing, and we would charge money at the door. It's kind of like BYOB,
yeah,
unofficially. And all kinds of cool rock shows took place there. That's before it was Byzantine. Chris's band was called New Family. They were like a metal band, and they would bring in some other local metal bands. There was another one called Against. Daniel's first band, Epic,
yeah,
they were metal band, and I guess my band, Harvest, was more of like the grunge era thing. We did like Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains type stuff. And yeah, we used to play there all the time. A lot of good memories starting out there.
What happened to it? Like anything else in West Virginia?
I went to basic training in 98. And when I came back, it was kind of fizzling out. I think it was just because everybody that was keeping it going, like Chris went to college at WVU, and I went to Marshall, and everybody just started spreading out. But a lot of those bands, Byzantine formed, and when Harvest split up, I started Guinness Clark's Wine, continued to play together. I know it's crazy that like a acoustic folk jam band, Guinness Clark's Wine, would be playing with a metal band, Byzantine, but we did some shows together, and it was like a mellow to metal thing, but it was cool. It worked. We played this old bar in Huntington called the Stone Monkey, which was kind of like the place before Marley's and the V Club. And we played up in Morgantown at 123. And there's another place in Huntington that we played with Byzantine. I can't remember right off. It's where
it wasn't Ian's, was it? The Schmuckers.
It might have been Shamrocks, actually.
Shamrocks, there you go. I think
it was on 3rd Avenue, so it probably was Shamrocks.
Yeah.
We did a lot of shows there, too. But yeah, that scene, the Logan scene kind of, I mean, it didn't take off from Logan, but, everybody's kind of still doing their thing. Byzantine, obviously, has been pretty successful.
They've been, what was it last year that they were, like, the number one on the metal rock charts?
Mm-hmm. And then they just got picked up with Metal Blade.
Yeah.
So they're doing...
Pretty good. You've mentioned a couple bands that you've been a part of in West Virginia. Do you want to give us the full chronology of that? What was the first band, and what are you up to now?
Well, I started. I guess I was in junior high, but it was basically a high school rock band called Harvest, and it was me, my first cousin Derek Hensley on lead guitar, who was a phenomenal guitar player. Our bass player was Josh Richardson, who unfortunately was killed in an auto accident on prom night, which ultimately is what led to me playing guitar, because I used to just sing and try to write songs. And Josh Smith was our rhythm guitar player. He took over playing bass when Richardson died, and then Josh Smith passed away. So we had a bad run of luck. Matt Gibbs was our drummer. That band, I think we called it quits in 99, and then I started Guinness Clark's Wine in 2000, and it was me and Phil James, who still plays music with me now. He's played in just about every outfit or project I've done.
He probably hates you, right? He probably likes you a lot to still be with you.
We get along.
Yeah.
Phil's a great guy, and he's got a good family. And we've aside from music, have just been great friends. We both like the same movies and music, and just, we've always been good friends. But he and I started Guinness Clark's Wine. We had Joe Bailey, who was also from the Man area. Mitch Linville was on lead guitar from the same area. And we went through a whole bunch of, we started with a percussion player, Tom Berry from Ashland, and Greg Radcliffe, who was a African drum instructor at Marshall. Greg lives in Austin now. Actually, last year when I was out there, I played with him a couple coffee houses in Austin. But we eventually picked up Daniel Johnson, actually, to play drums and incorporated a little more rock and roll into the band. We went electric, I guess. And Damon Adkins was the last guy that came in. And Guinness Clark's Wine played from about 2000, 2001 to into 2004. And then 2005, I did my first solo record, which was a do-it-yourself effort where I tried to play just about every instrument. And, for what it was... It was cool. I recorded with Russ Fox, who's a good friend of mine, Broadmoor Recording in Huntington. And he'd also previously recorded the stuff we did with Guinness Clark's Wine, so Russ was a good friend. Started to record the second album with Russ at Broadmoor, Front Seat for the End of the World. And I wrote that whole record when I was in Kuwait. I had a little four-track that I took with me, and I had my guitar shipped over. And I basically had about 14 months of sitting in a desert with a whole lot of downtime. So I taught myself how to play harmonica by listening to a crap load of Bob Dylan. I ordered a bunch of harmonicas and had them shipped over to a tent in the desert. It's crazy. You can get anything anywhere. So imagine, if you will, 130 degrees in the back of a tent with no AC, me playing acoustic guitar and learning how to play harmonica by listening to Bob Dylan. Now, the dudes in that tent probably did hate me. Yeah. But so I wrote a bunch of songs and came back and recorded what turned out to be a Front Seat for the End of the World with Russ Fox. And Russ made the introduction to Eddie Ashworth. He was like, you know, you've got a million tracks on this record. It's, you know, it's time we step it up to a, you know, another set of hands. So Eddie came and met me. I was playing a gig in Parkersburg at a, I think it was Borders then, but it was like a little coffee shop in a Borders Books. And we hit it off pretty well. The next week I went up to Athens and toured the studio. And Eddie mixed a front seat for The End of the World. And we pretty much immediately started recording Covering the Distance. So funny Bud story here. We were looking on a front seat for The End of the World. I'd learned from, you know, the previous record that I can't play every instrument as well as I'd like to.
Yep.
So I had written parts. I did play the bass on it. I played the acoustic guitar and all the rhythm guitar tracks and stuff. And I had Joe Bailey that had played bass in Guinness Clark's Wine came in and played drums on it, because Joe is like Bud. He can play any instrument he picks up pretty well. And Phil came in and played the keys. But I didn't want to try to do all the leads myself, because I wasn't really confident as a lead guitar player. So I did a couple, and then I had Tony from Byzantine came in and did two. Paul Calico from Route 60 Music came in and did one or two. And Russ was like, hey, there's this guy, Bud Carroll. And I'd heard the name from American Minor, but I'd never met Bud. And Russ says, you know, we should get Bud to come play on some tracks. So Russ says, I'll send him the tracks. And mind you, we kind of recorded this thing backwards. Like, normally you do the drums in the first few takes, you know. We did the drums pretty much last. Like, I went in with a click track and an acoustic guitar and just built it from that. So I have no idea what Bud got from Russ, but it probably didn't have drums, and I'm not sure what it sounded like. So we're sitting at the V Club one night after Russ had sent these tracks to him, and Bud comes in. And I had never met Bud, so I really didn't even know what he looked like. But Russ says, hey, there's Bud Carroll. Let's go talk to him. Bud's going to kill me. So I go up, and Russ makes the introduction. Bud had been consuming somewhat that evening, and he says, hey, man, yeah, really, I really wasn't feeling those tracks. And I was like, hey, no problem, dude. You know, thanks for listening and all that. So, you know, we go back and set at the bar, and Russ is like, I can't believe that. You know, I can't believe this guy. And next day we're at the studio, and we're tracking. Bud comes walking through the door with his guitar and his amp and was like, hey, we ready to do this? And just plugs in and kills it. And then I was like, well, that's awesome, dude. You killed it. And he was like, man, I'm sorry about last night. I don't know. I was not myself. So, you know, when it came time to do Covering the Distance, I was like, you know, out of all the stuff on the front seat for The End of the World, I thought Bud's lead worked better with my stuff, which I loved everything that Tony and Paul did. But, you know, I felt like Bud and I clicked pretty well. So I caught him up, and he was like, yeah, absolutely. So it was basically me and Phil, and then Bud and what turned out to be the Southern Souls went to Athens, recorded Covering the Distance with Eddie, had a great time. It's one of the best studio experiences. I mean, everybody kind of got to know each other. It was Jimmy Likens on bass, Steve Barker on drums, Phil on keys, and Bud on guitar. And Eddie, super cool. You've met Eddie,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, he's producer for so many different people. He, even though he's based in Ohio, he's done stuff for Quiet. And
I think we were the first.
You were the first before Quiet.
Covering the Distance was 2008. So we did.
I can't think of anything before Quiet. I thought Quiet's been here for like, you know,
oh,
like
no.
Three decades.
No,
I know they haven't. I know they haven't.
I'm going to lay claim. That's what I always tell Eddie. I was like, I'm going to get some royalty checks down the line for all the West Virginia bands. Which I guess Russ would have to get it, because he made the introduction.
You really weren't the first. Mm. You could try to be a hipster about it, but really failed. That's interesting. I didn't know that you went back so far with Eddie. And you still work with him. I mean,
we did four records with Eddie, actually. We did... if you count the mixing and mastering on Front Seat for the End of the World, five. So, but Eddie did Covering the Distance, then we did The Forgetting Place, The Line, and Learning How to Live, all with Eddie, all with pretty much the same pool of musicians, but it got a little bit bigger with each album. Like, when we did Forgetting Place in 2009, we added John Cavendish on organ, and Phil just played piano. By the time we came back and did The Line, we had... Mike Parker came in and played guitar on a track. Ed Price came in and played pedal steel, phenomenal pedal steel player and bass player, and he played a little banjo. And then Eddie had some musicians in the Athens area that would come in and do stuff. You know, I got so comfortable working with Eddie that I was just like, hey, dude, if you think it's cool, have him come in and play it and just send it to me. Like, I don't need to come up and be in the studio for that. And we had a really good working relationship. We brought in... are you familiar with Wilson Creek? Wilson Creek was like a bluegrass trio out of West Virginia, like Huntington, Ashland area. It was two twin sisters, Heather and Jesse, and Rudy that works at Route 60, and they were called Wilson Creek. They came in and played on, actually, I think they played on Covering the Distance and Forgetting Place, but sang harmony, played fiddle. The fiddle stuff you hear on these records are the sisters.
Oh.
And Rudy played mandolin, but just a whole bunch of musicians. By the time we got to Learning How to Live, I think there was something like 20 different musicians. It was just getting crazy. So
I'm trying to keep track of all the names that you just mentioned within the last 10 minutes, Jeff. It's
And I'm sure I'm missing a lot of people. it was kind of like a revolving door. You know what I mean? Like we would go in with the core band and record some stuff, and then Eddie's real good about like, hey, you know what this song needs? And you know, at first I used to be super controlling and I stressed a lot about it, but I got to the point, like I said, to where I was comfortable with Ed and was just like, if you think it's cool, man, bring him in.
Yeah.
So I would find out who played on my record when the record was done a lot of times.
Just so many different connections and different people that you've worked with over the years. How are you able to keep up these relationships? How are you able to make all those just different connections work out for you and your music?
Man, it turns into a lot of acquaintances because you can't really sustain like a close friendship with that many people. So, I mean, it's people that I have that I can like reach out to and hopefully, you know, they feel they can reach out to me. But like, for example, there's a dude named Bobby Withers that's played lead guitar on multiple records of mine, you know, tracks here and there. I barely know Bobby. You know what I mean? Like I've reached out, I'm friends with him on Facebook and I sold a guitar to him at one point and he's a phenomenal guitar player, but like, it's not someone that I really know, but someone who I feel like if I need some guitar work, I can call him up and he's there.
Well, I guess that's maybe a testament to West Virginians that you could call someone up. You may not even know them that well, but you can still rely on them to do something or be kind to them or, you know, compassionate and have them join the fold even for like a, you know, a hot second.
Absolutely. And I mean, for record making, it's great because anytime you need something, if somebody says, hey, you know, this song really needs some kazoo. Hey, I know a guy, you know, and you call them up. For record making, it's great. The problem that I ran into with it was when it came to go do live shows, you know what I mean? Because you can never really produce what you did on the record that has 20 people on it live if anybody wants to get a dollar out of it. And even if you don't get a dollar out of it, just making the schedules work is impossible. So that was my core frustration. And when it came time to do, I guess, the new record, I wanted to do something different. I didn't want to repeat myself. And like looking back over the records I did with Eddie, it was like, you know, we've done this, you know, we've expanded on it. We've got to the point to where there's 20 people playing on record. Let's go the opposite direction. And I'd wanted to work with Bud for a while, and I knew that Bud was doing, like, records at Trackside. And as a matter of fact, I'd played on some of those at Trackside. And we had talked about the idea of doing a record for a while. So after the 2014 water crisis, I was approached to do a song for a water compilation project. And I needed just like a quick turnaround. So I called Bud, went up and did Must Be Something in the Water, played it straight through. Bud says, I'll be done with it tomorrow around 2:00. So Bud like plays drums, bass, organ, lead guitar, rhythm guitar, percussion, all of it that evening, and calls me the next day and says, hey, it's in your Dropbox. And it was just awesome. So fast forward to early 2015, right before I got called out to go to Texas to spend a year, you know, with the Army at Fort Hood, we were talking about going in and starting a new record with, you know, Jeff Ellis and 40 Days, which was the band I've been playing with for about 3 years now. So we called Bud up and I was like, hey, man, I'm shipping out in like a week. Could we get in for a weekend and do a couple songs? We go in and do 3 days, knocked out 4 songs, top to bottom.
Wow.
And it was just an awesome experience. Bud played and engineered at the same time. I mean, he had like a little click pad here, so he would hit the track, we'd play through, he'd hit that, run downstairs and check it, and it was awesome. But it was like it was almost like being in a rehearsal. There was no stress, you know, because this, you know, Bud had been playing with us for a while at that point, and you know, all the guys were really comfortable there. We practiced there, so I mean, we're recording in the same place where we practice. There's just no stress, no pressure, a lot of you know, constructive criticism, if you will. Like, we've got guys in the band that really have little to no ego. So if someone, you know, Bud's really good at being able to say, hey, dude, that's a great drum part, but maybe try this. And Keegan is really good about doing exactly what you say and not, you know, there's no, hey, well, that's not the part I wrote. So I'm blessed in that regard now that I have guys that are easy to work with, good guys to hang out with. But so we make that record there with Bud, and we were basically doing it over weekends whenever I could come in from Fort Hood. So it took us about a year to make a record, which we probably could have done in 2 weeks had I been here. But it gave us time to listen to each session. You know, we'd do four songs, and I'd come back 2 or 3 months later, and we'd know if there's anything we wanted to change, which really everything's pretty much as is. Yeah. I have to say, and Bud would probably agree, this is the easiest record I've ever made.
Well, it's good, even though it's taken probably the longest to make it. Or has it been the longest?
Unfortunately, it has not been the longest.
Really?
Learning How to Live took us about 3 years because we redid so much of that record. Like we... long story short, if I can do that, we went in with like the Southern Souls and started the record, and then Jimmy moves to Nashville, and then John Cavendish moves to Nashville, and then Bud and Steve had a falling out for a bit, so like they weren't on good terms. So, you know, we start all over again with Sasha's band, which at the time was Steve.
Sasha Collette, you mean?
Sasha Collette, yes. Yeah. Yeah, Steve Barker was playing drums, Chris Justice on bass, and Jeremy Short on guitar. And Mike Parker, and we go in and redo some of those songs. And then some of that stuff wasn't working. So, like, eventually I go in, and Eddie hires a drummer. Jimmy came in from Nashville and redid the bass on everything at the last minute. And then we brought in some outside people that I did, like Bobby Withers was one of them that came in and played lead. So that record was, like, literally kind of, like, hodgepodge together. And that's how we got the 20 people playing on it, because they're still... I think 2 or 3 solos from Bud, and there's 2 or 3 solos from Jeremy Short, and, you know, I think there's 2 drummers, and then Tom came in and played percussion on the song. It was just, it got overwhelming, and it got to the point to where, like, I couldn't go to Athens for every little thing, and it was just, I think it was 3 years to really make that record that we spent.
That's crazy. I can't imagine going through that process, because 3 years, like, the records, what you thought would be the record at the very beginning is probably... not at all what happens at the very end of 3 years.
That's very true. Like, another thing to Eddie is he was really good and patient through that time period, because like I was ready to just scrap that record so many times.
Oh, yeah,
like, you know, I'm done. Let's start all over. But he was really good about keeping it going, and he knew when we needed to take a break, and he knew when I needed to take a break. And I think had I went to Athens for every single session, it would have been scrapped. So it's a good thing that he did stuff behind the scenes with me not there.
Yeah, or else you would have just been frustrated and be like, no, I don't, whatever, we'll start over fresh.
Of all the records we've done, that one probably bugs me the most just because it took so long and because there was so much frustration into it.
I bet.
But there were some really, I guess I could call them happy accidents, or maybe just... flash in the pan moments that came out. Like there was a song, Lullaby, that was like the 13th hour song that I'd written that I went in and did pretty much all by myself, and Phil came in and played some keys on it. And then I think Eddie added maybe Mellotron or something that night. But that song probably wouldn't have seen a record hadn't we not done that. And then there's a song at the, it's the first song on the record called Where Your Memory Can't Be Found. That is, I think, one of the best, like, just balls to the wall rock and roll songs I've ever written. And Bud came in and just nailed a guitar in 2 takes. And we still play that song pretty frequently.
Mentioned that the band that you're currently in is Jeff Ellis and the 40 Days.
Mm-hmm.
Why 40 days? Why not 30 days or 29 or 31?
Well, I mean, I didn't want it to be the Jeff Ellis band because we'd done that with some different people, some of the same people, but some different people, and I wanted it to be distinct. So I made the decision, I want to have a band name. Like, I don't want it to be just Jeff Ellis. I don't want it to be the Jeff Ellis band, but you guys are the band, so come up with a name.
Oh,
so everybody started throwing names in the hat. And I think it was either Phil or Rodney Critchfield, the bass player, that threw in 40 Days. And 40 Days is actually the name of a song that I'd written years before that was on the Covering the Distance record. And long story short with that, like 40 days is kind of like, I was raised in a Baptist church and like grew up singing in church and stuff my whole life. 40 days is like significant for times of trials, temptations, you know, it's like Christ's 40 days in the desert, you know, 40 days on the ark. Throughout the whole Bible, it's like times of trials and temptations and, you know, how people overcome that. So the song 40 Days was kind of like a drinking song, but overcoming that obstacle, if you will. And I think Phil or Rodney threw that name in the hat, and that was always the one that I tried to shoot down. I was like, nah, that's been the song title, and I don't want it to be the band name. I was thinking like the Heartbreakers, but that's already taken. So we did some democracy. It was like everybody vote on their favorite one, and it was, I think I was 3 or 4 to 1 at that point. And I was
yeah,
like,
you're
all right.
Severely outvoted on that.
I was like, it's cool. That's what it is.
Well, they like what they like. And, you know, they liked your song title for it. They liked the theme around it. Let them have it.
That's, yeah.
Jeff Ellis and the Ellises, you know?
I always wanted to call it Jeb for the Jeff Ellis band, but they didn't like that. So
it's stupid.
It is stupid.
I'm glad you didn't do that. Jeff Ellis and 40 Days.
Especially with the election this year, that would have been a bad idea.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think Jeff Ellis and 40 Days was a better option. Oh gosh, you've kind of gone through most of my list here by just naming off everything. I was like, what have you done with Bud Carroll? Yeah, I wonder what you've done with Bud Carroll. So you're currently based right now in South Charleston, correct?
Yes, I work for for Musically. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Everything. I have a house in South Charleston. Yeah.
So based in South Charleston, but you've traveled around the state, and you know, you've been through Logan County area and everything. How was it in the West Virginia music scene about a decade ago compared to how it is today?
I think it was Ian that said there's ebbs and flows, and you know, there, and I totally agree with that. Like when I first started as a teenager in Logan, we had a really strong music scene. I mean, it's Logan, West Virginia, but for a local scene, it was good. There was always somewhere to play. There were a lot of bands, a lot of people in each other's bands, and bands that were changing names weekly with different members. But I mean, there was always something going on. And I will say for Daniel Johnson, he is like, he's still doing it to this day, but he's always been really good about putting on shows. Like Daniel lived in Man, and they would have Man Street Fair, and then there'd be the Man Battle of the Bands. And then there was a skating rink in Man that had live music like every weekend. And that was the thing. Like we would go to, you know, to Man and or Logan or wherever at the Liberty, excuse me, and play. And like my brothers and a lot of their friends were all playing sports, being baseball, basketball, football. And our thing was always music. You know, if we weren't in the practice building woodshed, and we were playing, and that's pretty much all we did. And those, like I said, those guys are still doing it. I mean, Daniel puts on a show in Logan, like he's done up at the park for several years. I know what it's called, Rocktoberfest, 1 year, but like it's, you know, he puts it together from scratch. He gets sponsors, kind of like Ian does, just on a smaller scene in Logan.
Yeah.
And he's had Byzantine, he's had John Lancaster, he's had, I think Boba Flex came and played 1 year, like a lot of big West Virginia bands come and play this thing. And that was, I guess that was the, what I'm trying to say is that scene was strong. When I moved to Huntington, it was 98, 99 time frame. That was a pretty good music scene then, too. We had the Stone Monkey and the Drop Shop, which were the two premier music venues. I remember being underage, and our drummer's dad would take us to the Drop Shop and get us in. He said he was my dad, too. And I saw Corrosion of Conformity there and a bunch of other big bands. But we were still playing at Harvest at the time, and Harvest won a Tri-State Battle of the Bands that they had at the Paramount Arts Center in Ashland, Kentucky. And, like, we were kids, you know what I mean? Playing against like two well-established bands. I think Syrinx was the name of one. And they, if you're familiar with Splitniks, and they were kind of like in that same genre. And then there was another band called FM the Band, which could possibly be the worst band name ever.
Worse than Jeb.
It's worse than Jeb in my opinion. Yes. But we won that, and that kind of like helped us get in the door. We did an in-studio for Rock 105, and Rock 105 had us do some things in Charleston.
Oh, cool.
And then we did an in-studio for 106.3, who had just started, and like they got us into the Stone Monkey. We opened up for a band called Lux, which at the time was an up-and-coming band out of New York. And I think it was Southern Culture on the Skids. It was another band like that we opened up for at the Drop Shop. I think it was them. But that the music scene was cooled in. Like Boba Flex was coming up. We played with them a lot. Byzantine had just started. We played with them a bit. Things were cool. Chum was like, you know, I think at the tail end, if they had not called it quits at that point. But then it seemed like things died off for a while. During the Guinness Clark's Wine days around, you know, 2001 to 2004, I know Ian had the Love Coats.
Yeah.
American Miner was kicking up around the end of that time, 2004 maybe.
Well, it sounds like when you were saying the Logan area, it sounds like everything that was going on in Logan area kind of transferred over to different parts of the state.
It really did. You know, especially, you know, Daniel was playing in my band at that point. He played drums for Guinness Clark's Wine. And then, you know, Ojeda started Byzantine, and there were some other people. I'm sure there are people I'm missing right now, but so many names flying around in my head. But yeah, there were, you know, strong in Logan, kind of when we went to Huntington, it was strong for a bit. But I guess when everybody started like spreading out, kind of died off for a bit. And then I think it's really taken off in the past few years again, you know, with Ian starting the Huntington Music and Arts Festival and Trackside being a thing and like the Brain Rap starting up, like all these, I think I've talked to you about that before, you know, all the different things just starting to click and line up. And I think that with just the large amounts of talent around the area are creating this movement, you know, creating this momentum. And it seems like it's getting better every year. So hopefully this time it doesn't flow. It just continues to.
What about South Charleston? I mean, everyone talks about Charleston.
There's nowhere to play in South Charleston. The only place in South Charleston that I ever played was the Daily Cup on D Street and 7th Avenue.
And then they closed.
And then they closed and moved to Charleston for, you know, better business. And then better business wasn't there and they closed here. So I think there's only maybe one or two bars left in South Charleston and they're in the process of shutting those down. So there's really nowhere to play in South Charleston. So if there's nowhere to play, there's no music scene.
Yeah. So then who can make a scene in South Charleston? I mean, they're bands, right? I mean, they're people that make music in South Charleston. You're not the only person, right?
I don't know anyone else. I mean, I'm being honest here. Like I know a couple guys, maybe. I think Dave Roberts lives in South Charleston and plays drums in Charleston area. But like, that's the only dude I can think of right now.
So why live in South Charleston beyond, you know, the fact that you live there?
The main reason for South Charleston, for me anyways, was just because it's kind of conveniently located between Huntington and Charleston. I work in the city, and I don't have to deal with as much traffic.
Yeah, no, I mean, I should say, when I ask that question, it's not me saying that there's no reason to live in South Charleston. But if you're trying to make music and there's no scene there, then what do you do? Do you just move
Charleston
every...
or Huntington?
Yeah, I guess so. Or go up to Athens if you need to for Eddie Ashworth stuff.
Yeah, true. I mean, I guess it's kind of like with Logan. I mean, there was a music scene in Logan. I don't know if there is now or not. I'm sure there's still people playing and whatnot, but it's just not a big enough, I guess, area to... It's somewhere where you try to get out of, not somewhere where you aspire to go, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think you could apply that to the entire state going through the last few years.
Yeah.
That's not to say that's true, but that I think that is brought up more often than not.
I think personally, I heard Todd kind of hit on this in his interview with you, but like, I think the internet has changed that a lot. Like, Todd was talking about West Virginia being like a good place to tour out of, and I totally agree with that. Like, West Virginia is kind of like, in my opinion, the best kept secret because, like, you can live here, you know. I don't know about other people, but I don't like living in a big city. I like kind of being off to myself and not having to deal with the traffic and the crowds and all that. I mean, I like living here and I like, you know, a lot about our state, but it's also close to everything. I mean, you can be in Cincinnati, Columbus, Dayton, New York, New Jersey, you know, Virginia Beach, Nashville, all these places in half a day's drive, play your gig, you know, and come home all in a weekend. I think that's awesome. And with the internet, like, if you're undiscovered, it's your fault. You know, put the stuff out there. You've got YouTube, you've got iTunes, you've got all these different social media outlets. Make a product, put it out there, you know?
I've got my work cut out for me. I've got nothing but time. I've got a song in my head to sing, and you on my mind. I keep your photograph on me. I keep it close to my heart.
You have a new record coming out, Modern Time Blues. Can you tell us a little bit about the record and what people can expect to hear on it?
Well, a lot of the songs were written in a police cruiser. I'll start with that. I think I said earlier, I try to write songs that I think are interesting, and usually those come from characters or real people that I've met that get turned into characters, and real stories that get somewhat fictionalized, you know, details tweaked or whatnot. But a lot of the stuff on the record, right off the top of my head, Poor Penny's one, probably The Work, Must Be Something in the Water. Like, a lot of these are real, you know, real events, real people that I've come into contact with through, you know, police work or military work that I've thought just had remarkable stories that I was like, I've got to write about that. So I would, you know, write a little bit here and there when I could. Writing time is hard to find, by the way, when you have two kids. And that's why I do most of it in a police cruiser. But, you know, I would try to write stories that I thought were interesting, and then, you know, I'd take it back, and if I didn't already have a tune or melody, I'd try to put something to it. So I had a batch of these songs, took them to Bud. We wanted to do it a little differently this time. So rather than, you know, lay down acoustic tracks and do a lot of overdubs, we did like a band rehearsal. We went in, I would play the song for everybody. We'd play it a bunch of times, record it. Best take was the one we went with. Very minimal overdubs, you know, do some harmony vocal and occasionally some percussion or something. But pretty much what people get on the record is a rock and roll band playing live in the studio. And I think probably thematically and sonically is probably the most, maybe the strongest record that we've done, you know. And the title track, Modern Time Blues, we picked that one because, like, all the songs throughout the CD kind of deal with modern time blues in some way or another. I mean, Poor Penny, you've got this dude that's been on the road for 30 years with a ventriloquist dummy, you know, drives around in a box truck. I don't know if you've researched this dude or not. You have to. He's a real guy. Like, I've got to tell the story now. He's a real dude. Like, let me back up. 2014, around Thanksgiving time, we keep getting a call that there's a African-American male in the Southridge area with a small child walking in the traffic lanes. So obviously you hear something like that, it's like child abduction or child endangerment or something. So we rush out there. This guy is probably late 50s, maybe early 60s, rough looking dude. He's got what we thought was a small white child, but turns out to be a ventriloquist dummy. Dressed in child's clothing, has a wig on, a little ball cap. He's got this thing hanging off the front of him, and he's got this big, like, sandwich-looking selling billboard thing. You know, I don't know what they call those, but, like, the sign on the front and the back.
Yeah, sandwich board, yeah.
Yeah, sandwich board.
Yeah.
Like, stenciled, a mix of prophecy, a mix of scripture, and he's preaching through this dummy's mouth with a megaphone, just walking up and down the interstate. And I'm talking, like, some crazy stuff. There are YouTube videos. Please check them out. He has a box truck sitting on the Walmart parking lot that, I mean, looks like something straight out of a horror movie. And it is covered from the front grill, sides, top, back in self-proclaimed prophecy or whatnot, misspelled words, crazy stuff. I'm talking like Obama and Ronald Reagan are two heads of the seven dragon from the Book of Revelation. Like, crazy stuff.
That's exactly what the Book of Revelation says. Like,
I'm pretty sure it name dropped Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama. But, like, so, you know, immediately upon meeting this guy, I'm like, number one, he's crazy. Number two, this is remarkably interesting, and I have to know more. So, you know, like with anybody, we get his ID and run it. His name is on his driver's license, Poor Penny Carson. I was like, that is an awesome name. Poor Penny Carson. His dummy's name is Sweet Pea Johnson. So, like, I immediately go back to the police department, and I'm Googling this guy, and I find just a wealth of history on him. For over 30 years now, this guy has been driving around the country, works odd jobs, goes out and, like, to shopping centers, to busy intersections, and just, like, preaches this crazy prophecy stuff. And most often gets arrested, gets out, and goes to another town and starts all over again. But there are hits all through the internet. I found stories back from the early 70s, the 80s, the 90s, either like police reports or stories that people have just went out and been like, this crazy guy's preaching or whatnot, but there are pictures as well. So like I pulled all that information and wrote Poor Penny because I just thought it was, I was like, this, you couldn't make this up. Like somebody needs to do a movie on this guy. So that's Poor Penny. I don't even know where I was.
I don't even know if you can do anything other than that story. Like, we're done.
Well, the song is pretty much just a character stretch or character sketch of him, like.
And also a criminal, like a police.
Somewhat,
sketch, right?
Yeah. We, for the record, we didn't arrest the guy. We were like, hey, you need to stay out of the road, and if the owner of this area tells you you got to go, you got to go. But he was out there for about 3 weeks, and I started posting about him. Just, you know, I would take pictures whenever we're patrolling. I'd take a picture and post it up. And then other people start, you know, commenting on it. And I had all kinds of people say, hey, man, there's this crazy, scary-looking guy. I had my son terrified of him, by the way, because Charlie, I think, was 2 at the time. So anytime he wouldn't go to bed or wanted to do something, I'd be like, poor Penny's going to get you.
Why did you do that?
Because every kid needs a boogeyman. And now he thinks it's funny. But at the time, he'd be like, if there was a dark room, he'd say, is poor Penny going to be in there? He's like, I don't know. We better turn on the light and find out.
You sound like a good dad, Jeff.
It was fun.
That would scar me. Nah, like, if I ever actually met poor Penny, if I were your kid, I'd be like,
well, he saw poor Penny. Like, we would drive around, you know, the Southridge area, and poor Penny was out there, and I would be like, you know, poor Penny's going to get you. Better stay away from him. I'm telling you, somebody needs to do a horror movie based on this because it would be awesome.
And then the kid, the ventriloquist dummy would actually be a kid.
Sweet
that
P.
he,
Johnson. Oh,
the,
yeah.
Sweet P. Johnson's actually a kid.
I think at one point I may have told him, I was like, if you're not a good boy, you're going to be the new Sweet P. Johnson. parenting.
This interview series is actually turning into the hashtag WV Parents, where we give you advice on how to raise your children in West Virginia.
There's going to be someone looking to arrest me when CPS is going to be up front.
No, I think you've done a fine job. I've met your kids. They're very sweet, and they love music. They love your music. So now that we've talked about the record, I should ask then, like looking back at your life and what you've done in West Virginia, what's the one thing that you'd give to someone else to say, this is what happened to me, learn from it?
That's a good question. I would say just do what you love and, you know, stick to it. Don't give up easily because it's super frustrating. Everything, even, you know, I love making music. I love writing songs, but I get frustrated with it all the time. You know what I mean? It's a easily frustratable thing to do. But I think it's more rewarding in the end than frustrating, or I wouldn't still be doing it. But I don't think there's any one set way to do things, especially in this day and age. I mean, do what you love. Always try to, you know, to learn new things. If I have any regrets, it'd probably be the social media thing. Like I pushed that off for so long.
Yeah, that's the one thing. You know, you could have messed up at a gig, but no, it is you not posting to social media.
Well, I mean, just not necessarily posting. I just don't know. Like, there's so many different programs and outlets out there that I'm not familiar with at all. You know, I was just always like, write the best songs you can. And I still think that's good advice. I think, you know, if you're in, I think Tom Petty said it in the most recent book that came out, Petty, and I'll screw the quote up, but he basically said something like, if he's writing the best songs he can, the rest will come eventually. You know what I mean? And for him, it probably will because he's Tom Petty, but there's a lot of truth to that. You know, because if you don't have a good product, if you have crappy songs, but you're really good at Facebook, you know, all you're doing is posting, making great posts about really crappy songs. So, I don't know.
So that's one thing. The other thing I'd say that someone can learn from you is that Tom Petty is a god.
Tom Petty is. I'm telling you, like, there's a song on the record, on the new record, called A Heart Divided. And that song specifically, I mean, we set it up for the whole record at different times, but that song specifically, we were like, we want Damn the Torpedoes meets Darkness on the Edge of Town. And I think for of the whole record, that song captures that vibe more than anything else because, like, Bud definitely brought, like, the Darkness on the Town era Springsteen guitar solo, and we have, like, the Tom Petty and Heartbreakers harmony and, like, chorus type thing going on. So that ended up being one of my favorite songs off the record. So there's a little plug for that.
So Tom Petty, that's the one thing in 10 years from now, you want to be that person that Tom Petty like gives a handshake to or acknowledges.
Absolutely. My two of my goals in life were to play Mountain Stage and to meet Bruce Springsteen, and I've knocked those two out. So he has no idea that he met me, but he shook my hand at a concert, and I was like, I'm not washing this hand for weeks. But, I was fortunate enough to do Mountain Stage, and then I got to do it again, which was just phenomenal. And, if I could meet Tom Petty now, the trifecta would be complete. We'd be good.
Is there anything that I forgot to ask you or something that you wanted to bring up?
I would say thanks to you, because, you were a huge part of this as well. You know, the radio show and your work on Mountain Stage, and you're constantly promoting local music, so thank you for that, because that, in my opinion, along with Brain Rap and Trackside and all the people, you know, Adam, all the people that are pulling together, Ian, that's what it takes is a community. You know, I think it was someone, Ian or Todd, had said it before, but I mean, it bears repeating. It takes a community to make a scene. You know, one killer artist, one killer band is just that. You know what I mean? It's not a scene. But when everybody comes together and Nathan, I should say Nathan,
he's Marshall. Not with us today, but he's been interning with Mountain Stage.
Yeah, I saw that. You know, there's just so many people now that are willing to come together and help the scene grow and thrive. So I want to say thank you to you and all those people, because without you guys, I would still be sitting at home.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Jeff Ellis and 40 Day's newest release is Modern Time Blues. Hear more hashtag WV Music on A Change of Tune, airing Saturday nights at 10 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And for more hashtag WV Music chats, make sure to go to wvpublic.org/WV Music. I'm Joni Deutsch. Thanks for listening.